Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast in which at least two of us are probably not under alien control.
Well, the three of us do make a tripod.
Indeed.
Okay. You could have just given me that one. I could have just done that.
I'm sure you could do some creative, later.
We're doing it live. All right. What are we reading this week?
The White Mountains by John Christopher, which is not his real name.
Is it not? What's his real name?
I don't remember.
I believe it's Sam Yaud.
Yep. Written in 1967.
And narrated by William Gaminara.
He is a friend to children everywhere.
Is he really?
Well, so no, that's Gamera.
But close enough.
We're off to a ripping start today.
Yes. William Gaminara tuned into the podcast to hear what we thought of his narration, and then he gets juvenile jokes about his name.
He did a good job, though.
He did a fine job.
I think he did a great job.
Mm-hmm. All right. Would you like to give us some reading from the back of the book?
In the first book of John Christopher's classic series, it is the year 2100, and the world is controlled by the machines called tripods. Life goes on largely as it had in the pre-industrial era, as all of humanity is subject to mental controls that prevent anyone from challenging the established order. Will, a 13-year-old living in the small English village of Wharton, is looking forward to the transition to adulthood, which will take place on the next capping day, until a chance meeting with a mysterious vagrant named Ozymandias sends him on a quest to discover a world beyond the tripod's control.
Tripods, tripods, tripods. This is the world that Kevin wants to live in. All right, Kevin, what did you think of this?
What's that? What's that right below your hair? Is that a cap?
Shh. I think he's a vagrant, actually.
We already knew that. This book is awesome, of course. It's a classic. What else do you need to say? It's, quote, my first apocalypse, as far as I remember.
Not my little apocalypse?
It's pretty much, the boy's own adventure apocalypse novel.
Right. And it's funny because, a few years ago when I was kind of trying to trace back, I'm like, what was the first post-nuke book I read? And it's like, that one. I'm like, probably The White Mountains was the first one, fourth or fifth grade, somewhere around there.
Yes.
So, yeah. And then, of course, after that came out in Boy's Life, which everyone knows what Boy's Life is.
It's the scouting magazine for boys, I believe.
Yes. The magazine you get when you're a Boy Scout.
Yes.
But now they allow girls, so it's for boys and girls.
Just scouts. Okay, that was exciting.
I'll interject later. Don't want to spoil too much.
Okay, yeah. All right, Barry, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It was short, except even though it felt like it was a lot longer than it was chronologically.
Yes.
I don't know. It was very rich to me. I can't really quite put my finger on it.
He crams a lot of stuff into the 4-ish hours of the audiobook.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, I liked it as well. I mean, it was sort of interesting since I read it as a kid and I'm rereading it now and sort of now realizing the things that I missed as a kid. Like, I had no idea that Ozymandias was an important name back then. I just thought it was a weird name. Never occurred to me that it might be a poetic reference of any kind.
Tremble.
Yes, I do like your vagrant story.
Oh, yeah, that was it. This is, as far as I know, the first time that I'd experienced the word vagrant, because it isn't really in normal American normal English speech. Yeah. When you're an early teenager or whatever I was. So from that point on, whenever I'd heard the term vagrant, I always sort of assumed that it kind of meant that they were maybe from a secret band of freedom fighters.
Or crazy.
or something like that. It's actually a sports team.
We're the vagrants.
It's a little bit starker in some ways than I remember, and I'll go more into it in spoilers territory, but I kind of remembered the kids being friends a little bit more than they actually were in the book.
Right. I mean, I think later in the other books that maybe happens, but
yeah.
But I think one thing I liked about it on rereading it is actually felt pretty much realistic about, kids not being all angels to each other.
Right.
And in a way that maybe is an older style of writing, even though it's kind of realistic. I mean, of course, in new books, sure, kids are jerks to each other all the time, but
right.
Somehow it feels like it has a little verisimilitude in it.
Yeah. I mean, Will is not a perfect character. He does get some big wins in it, which I was starting to get a little concerned. I'm just like, I remember him being kind of more the hero. Why is he just sort of being grumpy all the time? But he does get some big wins. And so, yeah, no, I mean, this is kind of War of the Worlds post-apocalyptic kids edition. And
yeah, even though I was thinking that too, where I was like, yeah, the tripods are kind of similar to...
That's how I kind of thought of it when I was a kid, and I don't know if that was really intentional or not, but my thought of it was, this was okay, this is War of the Worlds, the sequel.
Well, the introduction to the second book of the series, the author talks about, well, I kind of made a mental gaffe where I thought I had sort of invented the tripods and then realized that they're really from War of the Worlds, so he felt a little...
He's like
sheepish about it at first. And then he's like, well, no one else really noticed, so let's keep going.
Well, also was, I mean, the War of the Worlds, they weren't, I don't think they were tripods. I think, were they actually floating or did they have?
I don't know if they fully described them, but I mostly remember the radio playing.
He was saying in the book, I think they were actually tripods in the text, but in the movies, they were more like a floating saucer.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's what I remember. Thing.
So people don't really equate the two when they read the book, unless I guess if you've read the War of the Worlds book itself.
Yeah, I think I have, but it's so long I don't remember for sure.
Yeah. But anyway, yes, I think we've completed our review. We all loved it, and it's I mean, it's a very much boys' own adventure. There are some female characters, but this is definitely from a boy's point of view in every way.
Right.
Which is what it was intended to be.
right. Yeah. Especially at the time, that was the market they were going for. Mm-hmm. The thing I thought was interesting really was... The audio edition does have a preface, which you might want to skip if you want to skip all those spoilers. You know, there's not a whole lot, but he does mention a couple minor things. But
I skipped it personally just because I'm just like, okay,
wait, I want to get to the book.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's not too long, but the thing I thought was interesting was where he basically said, I sent it to the UK publisher and they're like, yep. And then I sent it to the one in the US and they were like, the end's okay, but you need to rewrite the rest of it. And he's like, what? And then when he went back, he's like, oh, I guess she has some good points. So then he rewrote it again. And the UK is like, yep, sounds good. And she's like, yeah, the first part and the last part, okay, but you got to rewrite like everything in the middle again. He's like, rawr, rawr, rawr. And then at the very end, he kind of was like, I just realized that there is no such thing as a kid's book, really. It's just like there are books. And she was very helpful. And like, you know, it was kind of difficult to get a lesson in with editors at that age after writing 30 books, but you know, it was actually useful.
Getting highly critical feedback for an established author might be a little disconcerting, I guess.
Yeah. There are some authors out there that really could use that kind of editor right now.
Like us.
Well,
some very verbose people.
You're our editor, so wait a minute.
Yes, but I don't care.
And I thought that one of the funny things was in some comment I read somewhere, I don't remember if it was in this thing or not, that the author may have been one of the largest like mass murderers in existence because he'd written so many books about the apocalypse in different ways, flooding and freezing and this and that and fires and, you know, climate, whatever, that he's like, you know, you've written like 20 different books about the world being destroyed.
So he's basically my hero.
Basically. And actually, that's what completely blows me away is that I knew he'd written like maybe one other book about apocalyptic stuff, but I was surprised that he had written so many when I was researching him just for this. And I thought, how is it that when I looked for apocalyptic books years ago, that somehow these didn't come up, especially considering I'd read these, you know, the tripod ones. And so I don't know. I guess they weren't in print or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll put in a brief plug for one of his other books that he wrote as John Christopher, but it's actually for adults. Mm-hmm. It's called The Possessors, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's a lot like, say, Who Goes There or something like that. A mysterious alien entity that can seemingly spread from one person to another. It's really well done.
I mean, after reading this, I feel like, okay, now we have to have a spinoff, the John Christopher podcast, like we read all of his books.
The worst John Christopher idea of all time, where we just take the White Mountains and just reread it over and over and
over again. Welcome to the Christopher cast. It's like it's Del Toro time from that guy who does the Berenstain Bears podcast as well.
Your absolute favorite podcast, including this one.
You know, it's hard to say which one I like more. I think the Berenstain Bears is less work because, you know, I have to participate in this one.
All right. Well, before we unpack that one at all.
Yes. More bears.
I think it's time for us to fight the oppression that our anti-spoiler caps are making us go through and become vagrants in the spoiler section. Yay. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 All right, and welcome back to our discussion of the White Mountains. Before we get into any more serious discussion, it is definitely a sign of maybe the innocence of the time and certainly the innocence of the subject matter that we're having like this old man that is arranging a secret meeting with a young boy.
Right.
At our secret fort that we call the Den.
They did touch on that a tiny bit where after the guy's coming, he just remembered the story of some vagrant who had killed like a dozen kids in secret before they caught him. And he's like, oh crap, I hope that isn't him. Like, or whatever. Like, you're right that now you just be like, stranger danger.
Yeah. Nope.
Well, I mean, I remember when I was a kid that there was like a house down the street where this lady lived in, like her son like lived outside the house, mm-hmm. you know, and so he was like, you know, I think my grandmother always called him like the vagrant, right? Because they basically couldn't remember his real name and like, you know, never talk to that guy.
And he had a cap, but
yeah, I don't really remember, but he used to drink a lot of milk.
I mean, the funny thing too is like, oh no, it's okay, he's crazy.
It's not dangerous.
Yes, and I'm not entirely sure how much of the nuance that I got because I was still puzzling over the word vagrant when I was reading this as a kid. How easily he is convinced to abandon his home and just, you know, go out. It's just like, oh, so there's a place where a bunch of men live free without being capped. And he never really seems to express a lot of concern about being capped. He just seems to be vaguely unhappy with it. But
yeah, he's not exactly enamored with the idea of being capped. And, you know, especially after his cousin gets capped
right
in the first year that we're in the book.
But his cousin seems, you know.
His cousin got changed quite a bit, right? He's just like, you know, whatever, you know, the tripods are only here for our good. And
right. Right. But we don't really hear a lot of that. I mean, if there's a lot of implication. And I think that's a lot of it is the quality of the writing, where he's mostly just implying that, you know, his friend is sort of glassy-eyed, but instead just sort of says, oh, he's just really calm and now just keeps to himself and just is gazing from the other side of a gap that he's assuming that I'll come across soon. Or something.
Right, like yeah. I think it's also coupled with the fact that, you know, he basically lost his only friend.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, this vagrant guy shows up who...
He's like, hey, this is awesome. You should come here.
Yeah. I think that kind of like what, you know, gets him to leave home, you know, pretty easily. I also think that this is, you know, more from an era of, you know, free range children and the fact that
right.
young boys and men left home when they turned of age.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And, it's know. Not like you stay there until you're 25 and the health insurance runs out. Like, it's like, no, you're gone when you're maybe 16 or 18, like depending on, you know, the situation.
Right. Exactly.
Like you said, he doesn't really explicitly discuss it a lot. He's not happy with it, but he's like, that's just what happens. And then his friend kind of brings up, hey, I don't know, maybe this kind of sucks. And then suddenly, you know, when that changes, he's like, yeah, this does really suck. And that's when he kind of realizes, oh, crap, in a year I'm going to be. Although it does kind of another thing where they definitely show the main character has his own issues where at the moment of being capped and his friends like in the spotlight and be given like all the awesome stuff on the capping day. And he's like, well, I want to be like that. Like,
oh yeah, that's actually the most realistic thing is the description of Will, because he's not just the ultimate hero. He's
right.
You know, he's a tempted. Kid. He's, yeah. he's not just tempted. He's comes really close to giving in. In fact, had kind of given in.
He already, yeah, later on, he totally, you know, he'd already decided, he's like, yep, I'm going to be a lord. Woo, it's not that big of a deal to be capped.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, even in the beginning of the book, right, he gets beaten up by his cousin, right, Henry, quite a bit. So it's not like he's even like a strong hero.
Right.
You know, he's just sort of, you know, does his thing and
Yeah. I mean, his biggest win is destroying the tripod, which he almost does by accident. I mean, right.
It's totally by accident. It's complete happenstance and like just kind of otherwise the story wouldn't have progressed.
Right. And it's just like, and then I was dead.
I was capped. Woo, this is awesome. I love the tripods. That's like the alternate end.
Yeah. Maybe that's one of our billionaire projects is to write the alternate version of the White Mountains, which is called Being Capped is Really Good by Will.
Yeah, I can tell when I like a book because as I'm reading it, my brain's like, ooh, this would make a cool game. Like, you can make an RTS game like this. You're controlling the tripods, and you'll, it'll go to this village.
I kept thinking of the Toy Story movie and, you know, little green aliens that are in the picker machine, and they're like, the claw.
Yeah, so I've met the guy who does the voice for that. Of course, I'm a little terrified that you envision a game from the alien's perspective.
Well, both perspectives, but, you know, it's kind of like StarCraft, right? But you can imagine, like, you know, both ways where you're like, oh, wait, you know, got to run the underground, got to go scavenge for stuff. And that's one thing that kind of, you know, really hooked me as a kid, but also now is like, you know, the exploration of the ruins. Mm-hmm. And especially like when you're a kid, a fort is like the coolest thing ever.
Right.
At least I remember, you know, it's like, I totally want a fort. And I mean, you know, I'd make something that was, you know, totally not fun to be in, but it's still cool.
Hiding in a refrigerator box in the backyard.
Basically. And, you know, I think I vaguely remember like my parents were throwing away an old like box spring or something. And so I like had taken the wood frame and like used that as like the top of my fort or something like that. And like, sure, you know, just some old like plywood to make walls. And it's, you know, on the dirt. So it's really small. And like, I'm like, why would you ever want to be in this thing? But it was up for like 20 years, I think.
I mean, that's pretty normal kid behavior, at least boy behavior. I don't know if your daughter has built a fort.
She wants to.
Okay.
She's worked on one. Yeah. But yeah. And so the vision here of like, you know, hey, there's a lot of pre-done stuff for a fort. It's like this half fallen down, you know, power plant or whatever it was that they kind of, his cousin had set up and he's
6,600 volts.
Danger. And they're like, ooh, I don't know what volts is, you know, some guy's name, I guess, or something.
Well, but true.
But danger. Yeah, you're right.
6,600 of them.
And, you know, thinking how that awesome that would be to like go, you know, scavenge
by 6,600 Frenchmen. He was a Frenchman, maybe an Italian. I don't know.
Danger. But yeah, I mean, just that, you know, part at the beginning was cool, you know.
Mm-hmm. When I originally read the book, I kind of picked Beanpole as my identification character because, well,
he's smart.
Jean-Paul.
Yeah. And I mean, reading it now, he seems a little bit on the spectrum, which is fine. I mean, that's probably why I liked him so much when I was a kid.
That's right. He made his own eyeglasses, right?
He did. Yeah. But it's a little bit more obvious on the reread. Basically says that he's more interested in ideas than people several times. Well,
and like when they find the hand grenades and like it goes off by total chance to not kill them.
He's just like, oh,
he's like,
good.
Ooh, what's this? How does it work? Boink, pull the pin out. Okay, throw it. They're like, what are you doing? He's like, boom, that's crazy. You know, he's like, well, I don't need to do it again. I know how it works now. Like, it's just like...
Yeah, I thought the part where they're sort of exploring like what seemed to be like a mall or the entrance to the underground tube network in England was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of like wandering around. He's like, wow, there's like some sort of weird like little house down here, but it's down in a hole in the ground or something.
I know. He's like, who the hell would want to live down here and has wheels on it?
Yeah. It's like, I guess you could move it around or something, but it doesn't seem like it'd be very much fun to live in.
Yeah, they finally figure out it must be some kind of carriage, but I don't know what. Like,
right. Where are the horses? You know, where do you hook up the horses and what are these rail things?
And of course, you know, we're seeing it from a certain remove because we're sort of envisioning a future envisioned by somebody in the 60s that, you know,
the Schmontfair or whatever it's called.
I mean, I assume that means like underground train or something like that.
Well, right. That was the term he used for the horse-drawn train that they jumped on. But you're right. It's sort of like 60s future, but destroyed.
Yeah.
And it didn't age poorly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, it aged well.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote a prequel in 1988 called like When the Tripods Came or something, which I've never read, which I figure I probably will after I reread all these three. But but yeah, I'm sure.
Five times.
Well, I did read this about 3.5 times.
Yeah, I did as well. And I listened to the last hour again this morning for like a fourth time.
Yeah, I mean, but exploring the whole city and the underground part too was, I thought that was some of the peak excitement. You know, I like apocalypse portions of Apocalypse books that explore, like, you know, the ancient, and that's like actually what chapter five, you know, the city of the ancients or something like that, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Like, and like you said, it's books written back then, you know, this is like a really thin book.
Right.
And they pack a lot into a single chapter, and it's basically very episodic in the way it was written. It's very serialized, and I don't know if that was intentional or not, but.
Well, I think being written for the younger set, I think that they basically took like a complete book and like kind of like cut it down into three pieces, because
sure.
we were noting that like it was a very abrupt ending to this one.
Oh, yes.
And having started the second one, it just sort of picks like right up, right where the first one let off, you know, without any intro or fanfare.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, that was something that I won't say that I disliked it. It just really took me by surprise, which was we had just finished this sort of really long siege from the tripods, and
yeah,
where the guys, they can't fight back. They've done everything, you know, they've already been kind of amazing in even fighting off one, and there's just this huge number of them running around trying to find them.
Well, they basically spend about an hour of the audiobook of the 4.5 hours, you know, chasing them down.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And that was a long time.
That's a long time for that set of scenes.
And right. And then in the end, they're just hunkered down in this rock crevice, I guess.
Yeah. For like 2 days.
Just waiting. And they don't just describe that quickly and move on.
It's about 20 linger. Plus minutes of, and then, you know, this and that, you know, more lights were coming. It's like church lights. And then we got out because we were, you know, dying. We could barely move. And then 5 minutes later, back under the thing. And like,
exactly.
It was very visceral.
Absolutely. And then I think I was like interpolating like something from Escape to Witch Mountain or something like that. Where they come upon the camp, or, you know, and right. we get a description of what's actually going on in the White Mountains. And instead, it suddenly says, oh, and we did make it there. And everything was hard, but good.
Yeah. Right. And we're going to beat them one day.
We're going to beat them one day. And
we will win.
The disaster has made us all stronger as human beings than you soft people will ever.
Right. He's like, I wouldn't trade it for all those like sissies living down there and like the luxury.
And I changed my name to John Connor. I lead the resistance.
Yeah, that really took me by surprise, because I kind of assumed that there was going to be an obligatory scene there. And I wonder if that was there before one of the rewrites.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if those exist
probably was
anywhere. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. it would be, you know, they probably will never re-release it, but like in some anniversary, if it's, you know, hidden in a shoebox, it would be interesting to see the original draft that was submitted.
John Christopher's Silmarillion.
Exactly.
And then all of the tripods began dancing, and from the dance, the universe was woven.
I wonder too, is like, is this from the age or the art of cliffhangers? You know, it's like, because it's like, you want to get them to read the next book. So if it has a satisfying ending, they're like, you know, I don't need to read the next book. But it's like, if it just kind of abruptly stops, they're like, oh, well, what happens next? Like, you know, I don't know how much of a gap there was to the next. I think it's only like in the next year, wasn't it? Something like that.
But they did tell you exactly what happened. It's just that we dropped the narrative at that point. And
right.
It's just like, okay, yep, now we're just growing up and we're all becoming men now.
Well, I thought it too. It was interesting that he said when he was in the introduction, he says, when I was writing it, I had no idea what the tripods were. By the end of the book, he's like, I didn't know if the tripods were. In fact, they mentioned.
Were they vehicles,
or were they like, you know, intelligent machines? And like, I did like, you know, that was a very throwaway line, but he's like, you know, some people think that the tripods, you know, wasn't that the vagrant Ozymandias was like, you know, people think that they were like intelligent machines that humans created that then rebelled and conquered their human masters and became the new masters. And I was like, you know, that was the last they ever mentioned of it. It's like, I thought that was unlikely.
I suddenly realized that I gave Ozymandias Alec Guinness's voice when I was a kid.
That makes sense.
This is actually the parallel universe where like the Morlocks won. Maybe they created the tripods.
Pretty much, you know, but I actually think it does fit in really well with War of the Worlds. And yeah, but it is sort of interesting that he seems to have ripped off War of the Worlds and been completely unaware of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cryptonesia, I mean, that totally happens. Whenever I come up with an idea that I think, oh my God, this is totally original to me, no one else will ever come up with it. I remember writing this entire, like, first 10 pages of a movie script, and I'm just like, oh, and I could even tell you, I could trace back and tell you why I'd made this choice and why this was happening and why this was happening. And then I realized I had basically rewritten the first few scenes of Psycho.
Yeah, I have to say that you know, like a lot of the more recent movies, I'm like, well, yeah, that all like happened in the 80s. And now having read this book, and I'm like, well, I guess this all happened in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Eternal Return.
And then like even, you know, the author was saying in one of the introductions that he had unknowingly like ripped off War of the Worlds. I'm like, well, yeah, I guess everything old is new again.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you look at, you know, Hunger Games and it's like, yeah, Hunger Games isn't a ripoff directly of this, but it's like that genre has like, you know, a huge amount of parallels and
sure,
and stuff that even happens in later books, which we'll skip until in, and if we read those, it's like, you know, that also happens in Hunger Games. So mm-hmm. It's just like,
oh yeah, no, it's practically obligatory to a certain genre. You just kind of have to have certain things happen.
This is why we have the Trope website.
Exactly. My recollections are somewhat contaminated by the Boys Life comic, which I actually believe I'm old enough to that I actually read it when it was originally in Boys Life.
Like, because I remember I had read all the books, and then when the first panel showed up in the Boys Life magazine, I was super excited. And it actually is kind of amazing that they had the stamina to do that, because it took 5 years, one chapter per, and it's only like a half page panel per thing. And you could find them online pretty easily. Just search for Boys Life, White mm-hmm. Mountains. And it's, they're actually, were done pretty well. And then that was it. When I reread them a few years ago online, I, you know, was reminded the fact that I had always imagined the Caps, not how they described them, which happens to me a lot, I think, when I read books where I, oh,
no, mine's better.
Did yours have horns or something or what?
Well, no, I mean, in the book, they describe it as kind of a mesh. Mm-hmm. That's like a metal net that goes over their head and the hair grows through it. And I'd always imagined the Caps as basically being these like half to 1 inch thick, like basically helmets that were like, right, you know, over their head.
With a single aerial on top, with little lines coming out.
And
Proto-Cyberman.
I don't know if it quite made sense how their hair grew through it. Maybe I imagined like a little bit of a colander effect or something, but I kind of imagined the edges of it being these very thick kind of metal things when I would think about it later. And then I seen that, I'm like, that's not how they are. They totally messed it up. And then I went back to the book. I'm like, oh, wait, no, I guess that's pretty accurate.
Do we know who did the art for the comic version?
No, I'm sure we could find out, but I don't know.
Yes, we do. It's...
Beep.
No, we're not really going to fill it in.
I know. We bleeped it because, you know, it's a secret.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure that the webpage goes into that in the history of the artist or whatever.
I'm sure. Yes. And as I said, when I first read it, I had no idea that Ozymandias was an important name and that, yes, it basically was from, you know, Ozymandias, King of Kings, look on my works, ye mighty in despair. So indicating that human civilization has fallen.
Right. And of course, yeah, I had no idea at the time. It was just like, I don't know. He has a funny name. Like you said, like,
to the point where when I later read Ozymandias, there was no shock of recognition.
It's like, oh, they ripped this off from that White Mountains thing.
Yeah. Yeah. If that had made more of an impression, it would have been like Vagrants, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, but it is funny. So in addition to the Boys Life comic in the early 80s, they also had a BBC TV show in 1984.
Do you have that on Laserdisc?
No, I don't. Actually, the funny thing is I've never actually seen it. It's never, and the reason why, they never showed it on PBS in the Bay Area. It was never a license they could get for some reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they showed the Triffids, but not that. So yes, I've never seen it. I've been meaning to buy it at some point, but I've not got around to it.
So I'd like to give out another shout out to the narrator.
Yes.
William Gaminara.
Whose name we mocked earlier.
Yes. Not Gwillem, but William. I thought he did a fantastic job. Plus giving unique voices to all the people in the book. And then in addition, he did some great singing with Ozymandias.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. I kind of forgot about that. Yeah, no, I think he did a great job and, you know, yay.
Yes. Plus, I had not realized how much of the novel took place essentially in France. And I don't have a clear idea of where they were actually going. I mean, I guess the White Mountains are the Swiss Alps.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering, too. I'm like, is it Switzerland or is it just somewhere in the Alps? So, you know, showing my bad geographic memory. But
and so did they start out in England? Or?
Yeah. They started out in England.
That was the boat ride they took across the channel. Yeah, this is pre-Channel.
they show up in France, you know, and
then head north through Germany and, well, I guess it's, yeah, it's, you know, Scandinavia, Germany, that area. And that's actually one of the things I appreciated about the book is that it wasn't like, it didn't like kind of like rub it in your face that like, oh, if you don't recognize that this is, you know, London or something.
Right. They didn't have any flaking signs that said, you know, on Lundo.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, yeah, I was waiting for the part where, you know, they described, you know, something in Paris or the Eiffel Tower or something like that. And they did, but not like so obvious as that. Like, you know, they mentioned the cathedral. And so probably if I actually knew anything about, you know, cathedrals in Europe, I could probably say, oh, they're probably talking about, you know, that cathedral because it looks like that or something, right? Because it's in France in this region.
I mean, they kept it, you know, just vague enough to like kind of give you an idea sense of what country you might be in and just left it right at that.
Yeah. And when I was a kid, I don't think that where this was in the world ever even occurred to me.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I ever thought that either. You know, maybe the start in England because they mentioned stuff that sounded like, yeah, it was
all British, and stuff.
I thought it was interesting. I guess we haven't really talked about Eloise and like the whole,
oh, yes,
you know, his gentry offer.
So, yeah, most of civilization has backslid to kind of, well,
like a feudal
Renaissance fair all the time.
Yeah.
More mead.
Exactly. And it actually seems like, you know, it actually seems pretty good in some ways. I mean, they all wear these caps and they're theoretically under alien control, but most of the time it just sort of, you know, transmits an auditory Prozac type of deal.
Everything's great.
The tripods did solve the overpopulation problem for us.
Pretty much.
Much like Thanos.
Still haven't seen that movie.
Me either.
How have you guys not seen that movie?
We Live in Holes.
Yes, or something.
You mean like a den in like the abandoned electrical building? Or
actually, oh, I so wish.
You've got a den?
I'm going to make my own sign that says 6,600 volts. Or whatever.
No, whenever we're not here, we go and hide in a rock crevice somewhere.
Oh, well, that explains it.
All Barry walks around with a flashlight saying, tripod, tripod.
With those new LED flashlights, it really can look like daylight.
Yeah. And so, you know.
Okay. So Eloise, that's another illusion name. There's Eloise to Abelard or Abelard to Eloise. That was this famous medieval romance. I forget. I'm vaguely remembering the name from my studies.
I know what you mean now. Yeah. We had to read that in college and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I'm getting a little bit of my tuition money back every time I make a...
how far in debt are you still on that?
To my parents.
So nothing, haha.
A lot of technical support.
Yeah, and so basically, you know, he's sick, and just by happenstance, Eloise is sort of traveling the countryside doing her, you know, noble duty of sort of, you know, nursing the sickly and the poor or whatever.
Right, and her mother and so forth.
Right, and so...
And this is sort of the most cozy catastrophe things get.
Right.
Because mostly this is not a cozy catastrophe.
Yeah, which kind of surprised me in reread.
It's a post-cozy catastrophe.
Yeah, exactly.
He's kind of... He's tempted with the cozy catastrophe where, mm-hmm. you know, he's being nursed back to health by Eloise. So he kind of does a lot of day trips on the horse and, you know, really nice food and nice clothes and a feather bed.
And even despite his social gaffe of like pulling off like her headpiece or whatever it was.
Right, right. You're like, oh, she's been capped.
They haven't
bald.
Strung him up and like, you know, flogged him to death.
Yeah. I remember that like... That took me even more by surprise when I was a kid that, oh, she's got a cap. That really sort of startled me, even though it was on the reread, even though I didn't remember exactly what the revelation was, I was more startled that he was startled by it. It's just like, yeah, of course she's got a cap.
Yeah, you know, she used to assume that she was caps. A kid.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And that's what he thought, that she just hadn't been that old yet. But so... You know, basically, he's there for like, what, at least a month or something. So the parents whose their sons have gone away, you know, the nobles kind of adopt him. And it's funny, if you read the Boys Love comic, it's even more explicit. He's like, I'm going to ask her to marry me.
Right.
And, you know, which they don't ever mention here. But yeah. it's
somewhat implied.
It's implied that
it
could
comes
happen.
Right up to the edge of implication and then kind of backs
right.
off.
I think in the comic where they're like, well, we need to squeeze as much as we can into one sentence. It's like, well, that, you know, reduces that chapter by half now.
Sure.
Well, he like realizes, you know, she finally tells him that, you know, like, oh, you know, after the tournament, I'm going to go serve the tripods and then I'll be gone. I'm glad you're sticking around to, yeah. Do stuff. And he's like, wait, what?
Right. And that's the funny thing is he spends, quite a while that chapter kind of, he says, if you want to, if you're looking for a reason to do something, it's good to be, find a reason or find things to be irritated by that convince you to do that. So he decides his friends don't really want to be with him, that they just like each other and they don't like him. They would be better this without him.
Very psychologically accurate.
Yeah, no. So I thought that's kind of what I
mean.
It's
very believable. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like he's written in a way that, he's not the hero. He's a very, a character that you can definitely connect with and go, yeah, that's very realistic in the way your brain and where people work.
Yeah, but he's not an anti-hero. He's not a bad guy at all.
Oh no.
Yeah.
It's just realistic.
Right. Because just a lot of reasons for him to want to stay.
Right. People have doubts about what they're doing. And, he's just realized that he's not going to get what he's kind of like pining for. And he's I guess I'll just go and follow those guys. And
well, right. Cause he basically can talk himself into, okay, I'm going to stay, I'm going to be capped. He even says to her, explicitly, but I'm going to be capped, we can whatever. And I'm going to be part of the nobility. Is it such a big thing to be under the yoke of the tripods? He's like, when I get to be a lord, he's like, hey, it's not so bad.
Yeah, I get to eat and, have a dry bed and have a roof over my head all the time. And
then after, after she's like, well, didn't you know the Fair Queen gets to go serve the tripods for the rest of her life? Like,
yay.
And he's like, what? He kind of gets punched in the gut. He's like, well, okay, I guess I'm not staying anymore. And I kind of feel like an idiot.
Well, it's like his first crush, right?
Right.
He doesn't quite know what to do. He just kind of assumes that, if he sticks around long enough, she'll marry me or something.
Right.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly what I would have thought.
Exactly.
At 14 or whatever it is.
Especially when, the mother says, oh, I can make you ennobled. This is everything being handed to him on a platter.
Right.
And I do like also that he's sort of like carefully keeping his options open. He never actually says, okay, no, I'm staying here. You guys just leave me behind. He says, no, you guys go on ahead. I'm going to be noble and sacrifice.
He's like, I'll catch up in a couple of days. And Henry's like, yeah, right. You're going with that girl you like.
Yeah.
and the noble's new son. And he's just like, God damn, I hate that bastard.
How dare he say that?
I know. How dare he say the truth.
The truth thing. And it is sort of interesting because, over the course of more of the books, they do become more friendly. But right. I remembered it as them being closer friends in the first book.
Yeah, not the case.
No.
You could see by the end, there's a start of them being friends.
Right.
But it's just a start.
Yeah, you cower in a rock ridge for long enough
for 2 days.
Yeah, no eating. In some ways, this kind of reminds me a little bit of sort of like the Hobbit adventure in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. They leave, they end up in, talking to Elrond at the elf right. and, thing. And then they end up going to the bad place. I can't remember
Mordor.
The name. Mordor, yeah. They end up going to Mordor and hiding under a rock for several days.
Oh, that's right. True. They put your cloak over you. You're a rock now.
Yeah. The parallels are kind of like freaky now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. It's this sort of standard kind of
right.
narrative of that kind. And also probably taking place over the same, mental landscape.
Yeah.
Right. I did like the end of it where the tripods are playing with their golden snitch or whatever that was. Where it's like, oh crap, after all the stuff we're caught and everyone's like, oh crap, just sit here and just don't. Just they got us, and then it just runs by. They're playing with the golden ball.
I didn't even catch. So they were just playing.
They, all their effectors, whatever, were just flailing in weird patterns and stuff. But it said that they were throwing some golden ball between the tripods. So they were basically just playing catch or something.
Yeah.
And so it almost ran over them by accident, but didn't notice them. And that was actually one thing I thought was interesting. And
in the first book.
Yeah.
Okay.
I started listening to the second one and
yeah, no, that was right at the end where they're okay. Where they had, waited out the 2 days and then they're walking and they're almost there. And then they saw a couple and they're like, oh crap, we got it after all that. And then right. they made it through. But
and then they found the tunnel to the White Mountains outpost.
And then, yeah.
Dum, dum. And then done.
Yeah. But I thought
now the book is ended.
I hope you've enjoyed this book.
Yes, you were saying that the man we call A.U. Dibble
right, yes. did not record the closing line of the audio.
No, it was a different person.
It was a different individual.
He's still sulking from, you know, one of the ones ways back where Audible hopes that you enjoyed this book. I'm just like, yeah, I kind of wish I did.
I thought the thing about the language of the tripods, that considering the book is about the tripods, essentially, there's very little detailed description of the tripods themselves.
Right.
And I thought it was very clever that the way they handled that in book, that they didn't just, you know, oh, I left it vague because spooky or whatever. You know, he's in the, you know, he's at the tournament and one of them just walks up and he kind of freaks out until he notices everyone else is kind of ignoring it. And then it had come really close and like kind of it's like right overhead basically. And it basically says like, well, you know, before you were so terrified of them that you didn't look very closely at them, like purposely. So you kind of only noticed vague stuff about them. And he's like, so this is the first time I'd actually been that close to one, you know? So then he kind of gives a little bit more details about, oh, there were like, you know, there's the globe hemisphere on top. Right. And then there were like these green circular, they didn't say windows, but kind of like, you know, green circular window, like things around the edges and the bottom and a couple other things, but there's really not a lot of information about what they look like, which is, I don't know, I guess good and bad, but also means you could imagine it how you like.
You definitely had to use your imagination as to like what was going on with the tripods.
All I know is I want to make one now.
Actually, I have basically one that I, you know, that Arduino controlled lamp.
Oh, right.
We'll just get you like half a styrofoam ball and like some, some, you know,
some pencils,
tinker toys. And yeah,
take that, humans, get your cap on.
Well, now we know who Kevin wants to be in the book.
Get a bunch of Lego men and put a little bit of tinfoil. Yeah.
The old spaceman used to come with little plastic, you know, space helmets, just paint them silver and just stick it on there. You're mine now, human.
Get a bunch of pencils and get a bunch of those like erasers you stick on the back of the pencils and then
you're capped, you're a man now.
Yeah, I'll say one of the weirdest things that I remember from this book is like the strongest memory I had from a kid after several years was him losing the watch, something about his father's watch. Yeah. And him getting the watch and him losing the watch. And I remembered the scene of him losing the watch, and what I remember doesn't exist anywhere. You know, I mean, it kind of existed. Like he kind of gives the watch to Eloise and she drops into the lake. So I kind of remembered him dropping it in the water, but
he's just like, here, catch. And she's like, huh? Whoops.
Yeah. I remember the watch playing more of a role somehow in the book, like they needed the watch for something, or maybe they're just, it, you know, and so my brain has filled in gaps with maybe other movies or just the way, way your brain does where
Pulp
you miss
fiction, I think,
you know, kind of like where you misremember stuff, you know, it's, and so, yeah, when I went, you go back and you're kind of like half disappointed because you're like, wait, where did that part go?
Yeah,
maybe this is a different printing or something.
Always messes with my head when, you know, obviously, you know, it's from the Berenstain Bears universe.
Yes.
Right. Well, I think this book leaves enough to your imagination that it's easy to fill in like little bits like that.
Right.
You know, like, oh, like, you know, this is what I imagined would have happened or, you know, what may have happened or, you know, I've conflated it with other, other books or movies or.
And it kind of also addresses sometimes the, you know, it always used to be that no matter what it was, you know, I would be happy to see a movie version, but I'm getting to the point now where in some cases I'm like, I don't know if I actually want to see a video version of this. I mean, the tripod, you know, TV series, I probably would just watch it because I've seen pictures of it. But you know how sometimes you have like a voice in your head of what they sound like and what you imagine what they sound like. But the second you see the movie, like your brain wipes out what you imagine because it's more concrete.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's like, I'd read the Harry Potter books before I saw the movies and now I can't remember what they looked like in my head.
And you know who else has that problem? J.K. Rowling.
Yes. Yes, you know, I do kind of remember. I used to imagine Malfoy as, you know, wasn't Damien from The Omen or something like that. And
I think they got a lot of the casting right, but that's a different. So, yes. Okay. Yes. So, favorite scenes. We think we've already talked a lot about most of them.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, the watch. And the interesting thing about that is, like you say, I think your brain was filling it in because there wasn't a lot of purpose to that. And other than that, the prose is so spare. I'm actually a little curious as to why that was left in. It's a great bit of color where he basically steals a watch and it has no value.
Well, it introduces the tension between him and Henry.
Right.
Right.
It because makes Henry it sort of in, solid.
Yeah. You know, because Henry takes the watch from him because he knows he's not supposed to have it.
Right.
Right.
You know? And he's like, well, you know, your dad's rougher than mine. So.
and it shows a bit of like, you know, his rebellious nature. You know, there's a seed there. You know, he's like, you know, to put it on was a big thing, but taking it out of the house, oh my God, like I'm so in trouble now.
Like, he's like,
you know,
super if I careful caught. Not to wind it up too much because if his dad looked after he put it back and it was still ticking.
Like, why is it ticking? I didn't, you know, wind this up until like the last festival or whatever. Like, give me my belt, boy, like, you know, or whatever.
I'm going to give you a tannin.
So yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, maybe in one of the early drafts, there's an entire chapter about the watch. That's the version I read in a parallel universe. But yeah, it, like you said, it shows up. He gets his own watch to kind of like, you know, I'm the man now. I have a watch or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my own watch. You know, he in fact, even like is kind of another moment where he's like, well, they're being friends and I'm kind of irritated. So I'm not going to tell him about this watch store. Right. And then I'm hiding it on my arm. And then when it falls down, it's like, oh crap. Well, I'm okay. It's my watch.
There's like an entire store full of watches. He doesn't tell anybody right. else about it.
Henry's like, rah, 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 rah.
And yet, of course, I mean, it's meaningless.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you know, they don't need to know the time at any well, point.
That, and that's why I think I filled in my brain that it was actually a plot point where it's like, we needed to, you know, synchronize something or we needed to make it part of a device or something.
Right. We need to blow up that tripod at exactly 2:30.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, I think that, of course, you know, my favorite scene is just the action sequence of him being picked up by the tripod and, you know, hurling the grenade in.
Yeah, that was pretty good too.
Because it had flowed so naturally, and also they are, you know, first they're trying to blow it up. It wasn't their clever plan to, oh, okay, you get picked up by this thing and then throw it in. It just like, happens to work.
Throw it out the leg and then like that doesn't work. And the only reason he doesn't throw it is because they had cut out that little tracker from his armpit.
Right.
Yeah. The button.
And he like had, you know, he like kind of stopped from throwing it because it had too much pain. Right.
And I remember that scene where that got cut out very vividly. Yeah. And particularly the description of Beanpole saying there was a circus came to town and, you know, although I had forgotten how he had to sort of describe it and very, you know, describe yeah. what a circus was. And there was a hypnotist that got somebody to forget what was going on. So,
right. And kind of the chilling part where, you know, he's like screaming. He's not screaming. He's actually purposely not screaming, but he's like in excruciating pain. And then he kind of hears him say, okay, you can let him go now. It's like, especially the narrator made it sound like he was like you said, sort of on a spectrum where it's like, okay, yeah. I'm done with the operation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And right. Yeah, Beanpole was definitely a little bit colder in the book than I had remembered because I had just sort of missed the idea of, oh, he doesn't really like people that much. He's more of an ideas
right.
guy.
Right, because when I was thinking like, oh, who do you want to be? You know, like you said, my default thing is Beanpole. He's the smart science guy.
And I'm still, I'm still on yeah. that board with that.
And but kind of viscerally, I think, I don't know, maybe Will or something. Yeah.
I want to be a tripod.
Of course.
The one that got the grenade or
no, one of the more effective ones.
One thing that actually kind of stood out in this listening that I didn't remember so clearly was the different like klaxon calls that they had between each other.
Sure.
Whereas like, oh, this one was the 5-note, you know, kind of metal clanging noise. And this one was that one or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh yeah, in your land, you only hear the capping call. Yeah. Sounds like a good band name or album name.
The Not capping bad. Call. Okay. We'll add it to the list. Ladies and gentlemen, we are Cap and Call.
Exactly.
Clang, 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 clang.
Our opening act is the capped. Yeah,
clang, exactly. Clang, 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 clang.
We are Cap and Call and the Vagrants.
Okay, we have to do that now.
All right, yes. So, okay. Was there tea? Well, according to this that somebody has said yes, that it was chamomile.
Yes, it said chamomile tea.
it's like the best tea of all ever, right?
Just saying.
Yes. I thought about that a little bit, and I'm like, you know, that's actually realistic, right? They wouldn't be getting tea
that's true.
Locally, so, you know.
I mean, the only better tea would be Earl Grey, right?
Except from the city. They might find some tea in the city.
I do love
fight against your cap.
Yes, I do love me some breakfast tea.
It's made of breakfast.
It's like exactly. Bacon and eggs.
Yes, okay, and we've already done basically what character would you want to be. So I guess there's nothing for it but to just grin and accept our capping.
Yay! It's so snug, I love it.
Will we be a vagrant? Roll in D percentile and find out.
Oh no, we're in a place actually, where they speak French.
The sad thing is, I think, maybe I'm making this up, but I could have sworn they gave some kind of percentage, like about, I'm
they
like,
did.
About 5% or something like that. So I'm like, hey, it's like if you roll 1 in 20, whoops,
yeah.
Critical failure, you're a vagrant.
Absolutely that kind of person, aren't we?
Well, they did say it was like very, you know, rare that it happened, but then it said like 1 in 20. And I'm like, that's not that rare.
But you're right. That is more than you would think as being rare. But
I mean, rare is like 1% to me.
I was thinking, you know, of course, with the game thing during the book, I'm like thinking, well, did they actually ever have a Tripods RPG or board game or anything? Because it seems like it would work well for either as like a...
So anyway.
I think you're right. I think it would be a great, great module.
Yes, it would be. Okay. Well, if you would like to contact us, you can reach us on Twitter at SF3Podcast. By email, you can reach us at SF3Podcast@gmail.com. On Apple Podcasts at sci-fi, all one word. Or SF3, you know, it's hard to search for us for various reasons.
We made it that way.
Yes, only the elite may find us.
It's a feature.
We are a mysterious hidden podcast where people can live free.
That's right.
It's a hard life, but a good one.
Send us $55 plus postage and handling to receive your own fake cap.
Offer not valid in any state with a vowel. All right. Well, then, until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.